Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Let's admit it. Last week's podcast episode on the tax code and how it affects churches and religious charities was pretty heavy. Now that the April 15th tax deadline is behind us, we need something to lift our spirits. And what better way to do that than with song? Songs of praise, that is. That's our topic today. Now, we need to make clear from the very beginning here that although I enjoy a good religious song as much as the next guy in the pew, I am not an expert in hymnology or even in music in general. I could probably name the top 1970s Southern rock bands, but that's about it. And growing up, when I was required to join the school band, I chose to play the drums since it required absolutely no ability to read notes. You just had to hit some stuff, and I could handle that easily. And during church services, my pastor has been known to remind me personally that for some people, silence is golden when it comes time to stand up and sing. Nonetheless, I love music, and I was intrigued by a recent article in the online version of Christianity Today that rated the top mainline Christian hymns of all time. I think it's in our nature to be drawn to such lists, and so I immediately jumped on this article and tracked down the author, Robert T. Coote. Mr. Coote is the senior contributing editor of the International Bulletin of Missionary Research. He was previously the past managing editor of Eternity magazine. And in various email exchanges with him over the past few weeks, I discovered that he undertook this study to rate the top hymns out of his own personal curiosity. Now, as you know, we are a podcast that typically focuses on research by academics. But I must admit that I love the fact that someone outside of the academy is undertaking such an endeavor. It bolsters my belief that research and the creation of knowledge is not exclusively restricted to an anointed few, but is really within the purview of anyone and everyone with a sense of curiosity about the world. Bob, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. I'm sure that some people now are wondering what hymns are on that top hit list, but we're going to hold off on that in a second. I would like you to tell me what prompted you to undertake this study.
Well, it was rather vague at first. I was involved at the tail end of a major book editing project, and there were occasional lulls, and I began to wonder, what are the most famous hymns, and as I began the research into this, I discovered that there have been a number of attempts in the last quarter of a century to identify the favorite hymns of the Christian public, but they all seem to me to rely a lot on personal subjective preference and so on. For instance, a very well-known hymnologist of the late 20th century was a gentleman from England known as Eric Routley, and he said there is a canon of important hymns, and he named them 52 hymns. And then in a more recent time, another expert said there are essential hymns, and he named them, and both men said there are 52 in their list. So I thought, well, now we'll know what the real most favorite hymns are. So when I compared their two lists, lo and behold, only four hymns of the 52 corresponded.
Mm-hmm.
So it pointed out that this continues to be a very subjective thing. So I came up with the idea, supposing we could find a series of hymnals that have been produced over a century, and the same set of hymns would appear in all of them. That would say to me, these must be important, because the way hymnals are edited, you find that older hymns are dropped out and newer hymns come in, but maybe your favorite hymn continues to be in all the hymnals. So what I did, I found that the only way I could get a consistent series of hymnals was to go to the hymnals produced by mainline Protestants. That amounted to the Episcopalians, the Baptists, the Congregationalists. We know them today as the United Church of Christ, the Lutherans, the Methodists, and the Presbyterians. I went back to the late 1800s and started there, and I was able to collect all the hymnals that have been successively published since the late 1800s by these six denominations. And I came up with 28 hymnals, almost 5,000 hymns. And then I was able to see now which of these appear in all the hymnals. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, if you can get a set of hymns that have been published consistently by six different mainline denominations for over a century, they surely must be favorite hymns. And I thought that would, in a sense, take out the personal subjective taste. So that's what I commenced to do. It took me about 2 years off and on to record the first lines of all these hymns, but finally I had my 5,000 and I could look at my database and discover which ones were repeated in all the hymnals.
I think that's a really creative way of going about and doing this, and the fact that you were prompted to undertake this because you saw a disconnect between two expert lists, quote unquote.
Yeah.
The part that I really like about this, and myself, I'm a political economist and a strong believer in the economist F.A. Hayek, who argues that a lot of our knowledge comes from individual people. The fact that you're focusing on the popularity of these hymns over time in books really signifies that the congregation is giving some kind of input into these are the types of hymns that we like. Now, in your article, and we'll link to your articles online that you've written on this, you mentioned something about hymnal committees, and these are the folks that tend to select what hymns are going to be in various editions of the mainline Protestant hymnal for their denomination. What exactly is a hymnal committee? This is something new to me. I'd never really thought about it, but it does seem to make sense. Can you describe what a hymnal committee is?
It's probably inevitable that you would have to have a hymnal committee. The question is, how sensitive are they to what the Christian public wants?
Right.
And there are times when the committee's work has been well received and times when it hasn't been well received. It was interesting to me to identify quite a number of hymns just around the turn of the century that were in the hymnals in the late 1800s, but weren't in the hymnals in the first edition of the 1900s. And I thought some of these are quite well known. Why did they get dropped out?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I looked at the next generation, the hymnal committee of the next generation put back into the new hymnals a number of those that had been dropped out. So that was just an illustration of how the hymnal committees have to be ultimately responsible to the Christian public.
Right. I can imagine what just went on there. They dropped out a few of the popular hymns and tried moving on somewhere else, and then there were a number of people that marched into the pastor's office and said, "Where is my favorite hymn? You better get this thing back in here."
Probably so. Usually, at least in the last century, a typical hymnal in mainline Protestantism has 500 to 600 hymns,
mm-hmm.
and you may find that half of them are new, half of them are brought over from previous hymnals. A couple of mainline denominations in the 70s, we're trying to experiment with more liturgy, and in order to get room for more pages of liturgy, they dropped about half of the hymns that their hymnals had normally included, and apparently there was an uproar because the next time a hymnal came out for these couple of denominations, we were back up to the usual number of 500 to 600 hymns.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the public may not have a direct line to the committee right from the outset, but when the fur flies after the hymnal comes out, the denomination says, well, we can't do that again.
Yeah. How often do these hymnals get revised?
I was able to collect about half of them from friends who went to their church libraries and found hymnals that were no longer being used in the pew, and then the other half I bought through Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it took, as you can imagine, quite a while to collect all 28. I think I probably spent a couple hundred to Amazon.com to collect the remainder of the 28 that my friends weren't able to supply.
And just to kind of follow up, how often were these things reproduced?
Well, typically each new generation of a congregation wants a new hymnal. So you would say on average a new edition is produced every 25 years. Now that doesn't mean nothing was produced in the meantime. They might take the previous hymnal and put out a revision of it, add a couple of hymns, take out a couple. But I restricted my research only to what are known as new editions, not reprints, not revisions.
Okay.
Because the new editions are normally produced by a new generation of hymnal committees. And so what I have in my 28 is new editions over five generations.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a chance to look at any Catholic hymnals?
Yes, I did. Before I got through, I enlarged my investigation to evangelical hymnals and Roman Catholic hymnals. Let me back up just one step here. In the middle 1970s, one of the mainline denominations called for a consultation on hymns, and eventually they had 12 denominations involved in this extensive consultation. It included representatives from the Roman Catholics and Moravians, the United Church of Canada, and so forth. They came up with 150 favorite hymns, and then here more recently, I think it was in the year 2002, a Catholic hymnologist got a hold of that list and went through it and found that 4 out of 5 of the 150 hymns are to be found in one or another of Catholic hymnals.
Mm.
So one of the main benefits to me was to discover how much what we call now the most favored hymns, how much those are shared not only by the 6 mainline denominations, but by evangelicals and Roman Catholics.
Yeah, I was surprised by the fact in one of your articles you had mentioned that a hymn that appears in the Catholic hymnal was actually written by Martin Luther. So that was quite a surprise for me. That's really
Yes.
kind of the ultimate ecumenical statement there.
Well, it is really quite striking to realize what the names of the hymns are,
mm-hmm.
and the characters of the hymns that are shared by Roman Catholics. You've got things like Christ the Lord is risen today, crown him with many crowns, holy, 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 love divine, all loves that excelling, O God, our help in ages past, and so on. These are all very well-known evangelical hymns, and it turns out mainline Protestant hymns, And the Roman Catholics may be singing those same hymns on the Sunday we're singing them.
Yeah. That's rather interesting. Now, you're basically limiting yourself to American hymnals.
And yes, right.
And I don't know if you've had a chance to look into this, but I would wonder if in Europe there's a difference there, because here in the United States, Catholics tended to be to come in later than Protestants and maybe assimilated to the culture and picked up some of these hymns. I'm wondering if that's different in Europe. But
well, I did not investigate European hymnals at all. But there's one clue in my research. When you look at the hymn Amazing Grace, you discover that it's not in the list of these 13 that are in all 28 hymnals. And one says to himself, why in the world wouldn't Amazing Grace be included? Well, it turns out that this Amazing Grace hymn did not get well received in England right from the start. And a century after it was written, the famous hymnologist John Julian, writing in 1892, I believe it was, he gave a major work to a listing of all the hymns and where they came from and so on. And he commented that although a lot of John Newton's hymns were in current circulation, he didn't think that Amazing Grace had enough merit to be included among such hymns. And so it was not until the 1960s that Amazing Grace appeared in major English hymnals. And I think this kind of carried over into American mainline sensitivities. Amazing Grace kind of took root in our South in America, but not in the North. And these mainline hymnals have a very spotty record when it comes to Amazing Grace. And they didn't make the list because they didn't show up often enough in these 28 American Protestant hymnals. And so there are probably others very much like that, but I didn't really investigate European hymnals.
Yeah, I want to ask that because, and I wanted to hold off on this, but you did write a separate article on what happened to Amazing Grace, why didn't it make the list, and that was the biggest surprise on this list for me. Because
Amazing Grace was written by John Newton in 1779, it turns out that Newton's practice in his pastoral ministry was to write a poem for each of his sermons, and his thought was even if his congregation didn't remember the sermon, they could perhaps remember the poem. His people were generally uneducated, that they worked in the various industries, some about 50 miles north of London, and they weren't able to read. I guess the majority of them weren't able to read, so he hoped that they would remember his poems, and Amazing Grace was one of these. It was eventually put to music, and as I mentioned, it was not well received apart from his local area, but it did come across the ocean, apparently with Scottish immigrants that settled in Tennessee and Kentucky, and eventually it became popular in Methodist camp meetings, and especially it was advanced in popularity through a very popular Southern hymn book. And finally, by the turn of the last century, by the early 1900s, it was joined to the tune we're all familiar with now. It took a long while for that to get established. There were many tunes that were tried out with Amazing Grace during song program at his campaigns included Amazing Grace, but in a number of different tunes. Finally, as I say, in the early 1900s, it came to be joined with the familiar tune and was very successful in the South. Mm-hmm. But as I indicated a little while ago, the Northern denominations on which my research is mainly based were influenced by the early negative reaction to Amazing Grace, so that's why it only showed up occasionally.
Yeah. What is really interesting about what you say in your article, too, was the role of publishers early on in some of these hymnals. They're the ones who are putting these together, and it seemed that some of the publishers said, this Amazing Grace, that'll never stick.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, if you look closely at the words, except for the familiar last verse, which mentions God, the original verses of Amazing Grace don't mention Jesus Christ, don't mention God, and the last verse that we're familiar with that does mention God wasn't part of Newton's original poem that was written by someone else, and so it may have been that the early publishers back in the 1800s just thought it wasn't a good hymn because it didn't seem to be very explicitly Christian. But, you know, eventually in the South here in America, it did catch on. And then, lo and behold, in 1947, I believe it was, it was sung on the radio by Mahalia Jackson, 1947. And then in the 60s, Judy Collins sang it as an anti-Vietnam War song. And subsequently, it was sung also by such people as Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson. Arlo Guthrie sang it at Woodstock in 1969. And lo and behold, it then showed up in movies like Alice's Restaurant, Coal Miner's Daughter, Coal Miner's Daughter, Silkwood. And then in 1990, Bill Moyers did a TV documentary on it, and it's now to be found in the Library of Congress in over 400 recordings. So it just became immensely successful. And it wasn't, let me give a specific example of the slowness of American denominations to adopt it. The most recent Anglican hymn book from the 1990s, the committee here in America asked for this specialist that I mentioned very early in our conversation, Eric Routley. He was the director of the big choir school in New Jersey. Well, the committee asked him to come and advise them on their new hymnal, and he heard from the committee that they were thinking of adding in Amazing Grace. And it had never been in any American Anglican hymnal before. And he accused them of being too influenced by popular radio singers and so on. So they included it in spite of the Englishman Eric Routley's objection. And that just gives an illustration of how slow American denominations under the influence of English leadership, apparently, have been to include Amazing Grace. I think the only denomination that was consistent in including Amazing Grace in these last 100-plus years are the Methodists.
Yeah. And that's where I get a lot of my influence from on my music. So I was quite surprised to see that Amazing Grace wasn't in there. I can only imagine the meeting where Eric Routley is being asked whether or not Amazing Grace should be in there, and him just saying all of these newfangled rock and roll songs being put in there, those aren't going to last very much. And I guess that leads me to a question. And this probably should have asked this much earlier, but I think it's an important definitional issue, and we'll get to the list of the top 13 here in a second. But my definitional issue is, what constitutes a hymn? When I hear the word hymn, I tend to think of an old, dusty, leather-bound hymnal book that has its corners creased sitting in the ledge there in front of you in the pew, and I personally go to an evangelical denomination or evangelical congregation where we actually sing more contemporary tunes, such as Chris Tomlin, God of Wonders, which happens to be one of my favorite songs of all time. And we might even have some Toby Mac songs, City on Our Knees or something like that. We beam the lyrics of the songs up on a big screen so everybody can look up and see it. But what defines a hymn, and do some of these more contemporary songs, would they constitute hymns?
Well, hymns are relatively recent in Christian history, believe it or not. You probably remember that in the 1600s, 1700s, the kind of singing that was done in Christian communities came out of the Psalms, and they spoke of the Psalter, and this was a book of Psalms, and they could use these books to sing the Psalms that had been kind of rhymed, and because these hymns, these Psalms, came out of the book of Psalms, everyone felt confident that they were singing exactly what God would want them to. They weren't making anything up. They had the authority of the Psalms behind them. The only trouble was it got to be pretty boring. The tunes were often virtually awful.
Yeah.
And Isaac Watts comes along in the very early 1700s, and he complained to his preacher father that, "I'm so tired and bored with these songs." And the father said, "Well, see if you can do something better." So Isaac Watts began to write hymns as opposed to psalms. He still based it on psalms. "O God, our help in ages past." I think that one's based on Psalm 90. And so he tried to be faithful to the idea that we want to sing according to what God has revealed in the Scriptures. But he broke away from the strict business of the reordering of the psalm language and the boring tunes that went with that, and he really introduced a brand new thing. That's the early 1700s. It took a while for that to be accepted beyond a few congregations, but, you know, it would gradually make way. And eventually it passed into Baptist circles around the very end of the 1700s and the beginning of the 1800s. There was a Baptist pastor in London by the name of John Rippon, and he wanted to help circulate Isaac Watts's hymns, but he was also familiar with some of Charles Wesley's hymns. So he put together a hymn book that was based on Isaac Watts, but was supplemented with a number of other hymns as well. Interestingly enough, Wesley's hymns, while also related to Scripture, were not so exactly tied to Scripture as Watts's were. His hymns tended to be testimonial. And he, in other words, they had a more subjective element to them. They talked about the experience of the believer in coming to know Christ, coming to experience the forgiveness of sins, the renewal of life, and all that. So it brought in a very strong personal dimension in hymn singing. But like Isaac Watts's hymns, Samuel Wesley's hymns also took a while to gain a foothold. They would go in some of the early evangelical Anglican communities, but it takes time for this to catch hold. And I remember an illustration of this fact, that it takes time. When Moody was in England in the, I think it was the 1870s, one of his tours, his song man, Ira Sankey, wanted to introduce a new hymn that he had written. It was about the good shepherd looking for the lost sheep. In the audience was a woman from Scotland, and as soon as she heard this song begun by Sankey, she said, "Let me out, let me out, oh God, let me out." And she hurried from her pew and ran out the back of the church. She didn't want anything but songs from the Psalter.
Yeah.
So, you know, here we are, 100 years after Wesley, almost 200 years after Watts, and there are still people around that want to sing only from the Psalter.
Mm-hmm.
But by the middle of the 1800s, hymns had definitely gotten a foothold, and that's why we are so familiar with them today. It would be interesting to speculate how long it will take for all churches to adopt our new current types of song, which you've experienced in your church and which I experience in mine. Personally, I still love the hymns, and I hope it's correct that I read in a book by Mark Knoll, and the name is running from me at the moment, the president of Fuller Seminary. He says he thinks the new type of singing is a new version of the Psalter, and he thinks hymns are going to come back in full force someday soon. So we'll see what happens.
Well, let's hold off that discussion a little bit, because I'm curious how hymns will progress, especially mainline hymns, when we start to see a movement toward more non-denominational churches. But let's hold that off for a bit. And I think our listeners have been wondering what hymns have actually hit upon the top list of all time. And you mentioned 27 here in your list, and we're going to put a link to this on our website. For individuals who want to check out the entire list, you can consult our website and click on the link, and you'll be able to see which hymnals these actually appear in. But here's the top 13, and these top 13 are defined by hymns that have appeared consistently in all of the hymnals that you examine. And these are an alphabetical list. I'll just read through these quickly and give the dates that they're listed. And I have a few comments I want to make after that.
Okay.
The first one is "Abide With Me, Fast Falls the Eventide." That was written in 1847. "All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name" in 1779. "Come, Ye Thankful People, Come" in 1844. "Crown Him with Many Crowns" 1851. "Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken" 1779. "Guide Me, O Thou Great Jehovah" in 1745. "Holy, Holy, Holy, Lord God Almighty" in 1826. "How Firm a Foundation, Ye Saints" 1787. "In the Cross of Christ I Glory" 1825. "Jesus Shall Reign Where the Sun" 1719. "Love Divine, All Love Excelling" 1747. "O Sacred Head Now Wounded," and this is one that dates back to the 12th century.
Yes.
By Bernard of Clairvaux. And then finally the last one, and again these are alphabetical order, so it's not necessarily this is the top one and such, but the last of the 13 top ones that are in all hymnals is "When I Survive the Wondrous Cross" 1707. Now looking at this list, I tend to see, with one or two exceptions here, that most of these popular hymns were written in roughly the latter half of the 18th century, or from about 1740, and go up to about 1850? Is there something specific about that time period that made these hymns? Now, I guess you were talking about how we're moving away from the Psalter during this period of time in the early 1700s and then moving to hymns. So this is essentially the birthplace of many of these hymns, and those are the ones that take root. Is that correct?
Yeah, I do see something central about these hymns, but I don't think it particularly connects to the time period they were written in. I think what is special about these hymns is that they are so central to Christian belief. Mm-hmm. They faithfully represent what the scriptures have told us about God's salvation, the role of Jesus in winning our reprieve from God's judgment, bringing us grace and new life. If you go through these hymns and look at the verses, it's very clear that you're practically sitting in an adult Sunday school class being told what God has done for humankind that brings us into fellowship of His church. So I think it's the fact that these hymns are so basic to Christian belief that accounts for their survival over 200 years. As you say, if you took the average date that these were written in, it's the late 1700s. Now, just think what that means. If we go back to the 1700s, if I go back in my own family, we're talking about my great-great grandfather around 1800, and we can go forward to my grandson Ian and my granddaughter Amy, who are about to enter college. That's nine generations. We have been singing these hymns for nine generations. Mm-hmm. And as I indicated earlier, on any given Sunday, it might be that people in a mainline Protestant denomination are singing some of these, and evangelicals in some of their congregations are singing some of these, and Roman Catholics are singing some of these. Mm-hmm. I think this all goes to underline the fact that these are truly fundamental to Christian identity. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the experiments that go on each new generation with new hymns, if they don't come up to that kind of standard, well, they eventually drop out of sight.
Yeah.
So I think the explanation for them is not when they were written, but the fact that they were written about the basic substance of Christian life and faith.
One of the things that I noticed reading through this list, and once I saw the list, I love lists, I had to think back on my favorite hymns, and so I started creating a mental list in my head, and ones that came to mind were Blessed Assurance, The Old Rugged Cross, How Great Thou Art, I'll Fly Away, and I started wondering why these didn't make the list, and I did a little bit of research by myself and found that most of these that I tend to remember were written in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and I'm wondering why those didn't make the list.
Yeah, well, of course, if they were written in 1900 or after, they did not fit my definition. My definition was, if you're going to have a favorite hymn, my definition was it had to appear in the hymnals of the late 1800s and in all the hymnals since then, 28 hymnals, six denominations. In other words, my definition was very, very demanding.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that 50 years from now, if somebody were to do this again, the hymn that you've just now listed would appear, but by then they would be 100 years old or more.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of the definition that I use to arrive at these favorite hymns.
I was just wondering if, and this is, for me, it's rather interesting coming from an evangelical tradition, that many of my favorite hymns that I consider to be the old hymns were written around that time, about the late 1800s, early 1900s, and we saw a revival of fundamentalism at this period of time. That, you know, the book The Fundamentals was written by A.C. Dixon, and there seemed to be a reinvigoration of faith there. Do you think there was any type of renaissance in hymn writing during this period of time that you picked up in your research?
Well, I'm not an expert in that, but I've read that the latter part of the 19th century, maybe from 1850 to the 1900 period, saw quite a revival, or rather expansion, of hymn writing. This would be what is known as the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. And my observation, I don't know that it applies to the hymns you've mentioned, but my observation is that many of those hymns were rather overly sentimental. And it's interesting, by the time you look at the hymnal, the first edition of these hymnals in the 1900s, about half of the hymns that were in the 1880s hymnal have dropped out. And as each subsequent edition is put out during our last century, more and more of these hymns from the 1800s are dropped from view. And I personally speculate that this is because they were often unduly sentimental. Sometimes one or more of these hymns are almost embarrassing to read, because it's using language like we use in marriage and to our loved one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And not that God isn't our loved one, but the language is just too strong. Well, I'm not using the right word here.
I guess something similar to a junior high school poem. Yeah. I guess something similar to a junior high school poem or something like that.
Yeah.
When looking through this list, too, and again, you have the top 27, and you've read through, you know, thousands of these hymns to figure out which ones made it and which ones didn't. Were there any individuals who stood out as prolific hymn writers?
Well, I think no one will be surprised to learn that Charles Wesley has the most hymns of the 27 listed. Let's explain a minute that we get 27 because we have the 13 that appeared in all 28 hymnals. Then you get another 9 that appeared in all but one of the 28 hymnals. And finally, I added 5 that appear in all but 2 of the hymnals. I decided to draw the line at that point. That gave us 27 hymns, and I felt that the very fact that they appear in all these hymnals helps us to say confidently these are favorite hymns. And when you look at the list of 27, Charles Wesley stands out, Isaac Watts stands out, and I think it's something like Watts has 2 or 3 and Wesley has 3 or 4. The rest of the 27, I think, are written by individuals. I don't think there's anyone other than Wesley and Watts who wrote more than one of these hymns.
Mm-hmm. Actually, St. Bernard of Clairvaux actually has 2 in the top 27. He had one that we mentioned in the top 13, and then he also had one in the top 25, too. So we should give that 12th century Christian his due as well. And going through this must have been a really enjoyable project, and looking back at some of these hymnals, but also listening to them and humming them or thinking through them in your mind as you're going through there. Are there any ones of these hymns that you consider your favorite? Your favorites?
Well, yes. I grew up in my college years learning the hymns in the InterVarsity hymnal, and about half of the hymns in the InterVarsity hymnal are also in the research that I worked on. But I think my favorite goes back to my experience in high school. I was in the high school choir, and we sang Isaac Watts' "O God, Our Help in Ages Past." And now for 60 years or more, that hymn comes into my mind repeatedly. Anytime I sense a particular challenge ahead of me, I find myself going over the word silently in my mind or humming it if there's nobody around to hear me, and or if there's tension in the room, whether it's a board meeting or whatever the circumstance, I find myself going back, "Oh God, our help in ages past." You know, that is a very fine favorite for me. I also find myself singing Watts's "Jesus Shall Reign Where'er the Sun." I like that one very much. And one that also became a favorite because it was in the InterVarsity hymn book is John Bowring's "In the Cross of Christ Thy Glory." And the story of that hymnal has been told this way, that Bowring was an English diplomat, and when he was on a ship and pulled into the Chinese port, he saw on a hill a cathedral-like church that had been burned in some kind of uprising, but the front facade of the church was intact and the cross was still on the top of the facade, and he was prompted to write, "In the Cross of Christ Thy Glory." I like that very, very much.
It's interesting that you do hum some of these hymns, you know, from your high school years or during your college years in the InterVarsity hymnal, because I, as you mentioned that, I remember that I have the similar tendency to do that. In times of great joy, I can't help but, you know, sing out "Amazing Grace," and it comes up at various different points in time. Even in times of trouble, they really resonate with me. There's something that goes back to me, and when I hear those songs, it really inspires me in a number of different ways. And I'm thinking about all the other ones that I had mentioned, "Blessed Assurance," or "Power in the Blood" is another one of my favorite that was written around at the turn of the 20th century.
So, which one?
"Power in the Blood."
Oh, yes.
Which, for me, it's a really energizing, you know, type of hymn that just keeps me going. It really is filled with spiritual nourishment. And I guess that speaks to the fact that many of these hymns really are eternal, that they talk to the eternal Word of God, but they linger with us quite a long time. And I guess I'm now starting to reflect about the contemporary hymnal theme, I call it that. There's been an explosion of Christian contemporary music, from country Christian music has been very popular. I enjoy listening to that, all the way to hip-hop and rap music, stars starting to get into singing songs of praise. What's your perspective on the contemporary Christian music scene? Do you think that traditional hymns are going to fade away, or are they going to be incorporated into some of this new music, and is some of this newer music just transitory?
Well, I would make my comment based on what happened to the great outpouring of hymns in the Victorian era. Time will sift out the less vital ones, the ones that don't quite make it, the ones that are to a tune that seems awkward to sing and learn. I think the very fact that these modern praise songs are not given to the congregation with music is going to hurt them in the long run. All we have to go by is the words on the screen up at the front of the auditorium, and we kind of pick up the tune from those up front who are leading us, but some of us like to have the music in front of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, when in the best experiences of hymn singing, different people in the audience will take up the soprano and the alto, the tenor and the bass, And that just gives a richness that I think we're losing out on in the current praise music. On the other hand, as I indicated earlier, you can look at these praise songs, many of them, as a kind of a modern version of the Psalter. They concentrate so much on the praise of God, which makes them much like what we see in the Psalms. And I do find myself once in a while during the week humming something that was sung at church in the praise song genre. And I say to myself, now where did that come from? And I think of my InterVarsity hymn book, and it didn't come from that. And then it dawns on me, lo and behold, I've remembered this from church. Mm-hmm. It's one of these new praise songs, and I'm really quite surprised. So, you know, it takes a long time for the less vibrant hymns to drop out from sight, and I think we'll see the same thing with the praise songs. Maybe 50 years from now, we will have, say, 15 to 20% of the praise songs still being sung because they have won the hearts of people. The tunes are easy to remember. The words resonate with us as we think of the Psalms when we sing of them. So, you know, it's just a matter of time. I found out in my research on the late 1800s set of hymns, half of them were gone by the first edition of the hymn books in the new century. I mentioned that earlier. And then in each successive edition, more drop out. Until today, in our current hymn books in the mainline churches, only less than 1 in 5 of the hymns that were being sung over 100 years ago are still being sung today, or at least showing up in our hymn books. So it's a long weeding process to make sure we're retaining only the best.
I want to back up just a minute because you made a great observation about the music and having it in book form in front of you. And as I think about this now at my Sunday services, again, as I mentioned, we have the lyrics up there on the screen, but there's no musical notes or anything. The other thing that struck me too was that we have a band playing, electric guitars, bass guitars, pianos, the microphones are used to amplify the voices and such, and you really don't hear the congregation that much. But there are times where the music pastor will tone down the music and let the congregation sing. Those are times that really affect me. When you hear the congregation singing, it just sends this tingle up your spine and gives you the sense of connectedness with everybody in the room. And I'm wondering if modern technology and the, you know, rock bands that are in front of the congregation are diminishing some of that connection that we have.
Well, that's my observation. In fact, it's literally embarrassing when I stand in my seat. I mean, we're all standing from our seats. When I look around from toward the back of the auditorium where I usually sit, and I look across the audience, it is embarrassing to realize how many people are standing there with their mouths shut. We're just listening as though we are being entertained.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, is one of the more serious weaknesses of our current praise song trends. I think we need to work harder at teaching them to the congregation, making them familiar with the tunes. Maybe that would force the leadership to drop those that don't have such an attractive tune, that are tunes that are kind of hard to remember. In our church, I'm noticing an increasing effort to combine the hymn heritage with the new praise songs. And I think it's a move in the right direction. There may be much to be accomplished if we pick the best of the praise songs and combine it with the best of the hymns. In the case of Amazing Amazing Grace, and then they add a chorus, and it was that chorus that played through my mind later on, and I said to myself, that sounds familiar. Where is it in the InterVarsity hymn book? Well, the hymn was in the InterVarsity hymn book, but the chorus was from this new movement for praise songs. And, you know, to me, that's going to be a keeper.
I think I know what song you're talking about. It's a modification of Amazing Grace by Chris Tomlin that he sings My Chains Are Gone in there, which is a very moving version of the song. And I really quite enjoy it. And I mean, in partial defense of the new musical tradition that we're seeing in a number of churches too, there are some songs that really resonate with me and then really make me want to sing out. And there's people in our church that just, you know, raise their hands. They really get energized by some of this music. And we even got a member of our church up front who brings his tambourine every week and he plays along with the band. And so, you know, some people don't sing. Some people are there just to be entertained, but there's an aspect that it is energized. The last question I want to ask you, and it relates to this question and the preservation of these hymnals. We are now in an era where we're seeing an increasing number of non-denominational churches. So when you looked at, and when you did your study, you looked at the Presbyterian hymnal throughout time or the Methodist hymnal. With these non-denominational churches, is there a risk that we might be losing some of this heritage because there's no one to be keeping it?
Well, I'm a little more optimistic than that question implies, because, as we've already noted, are also in the evangelical repertoire, and some of the best evangelical hymns. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
I hear a beep as though we got a problem here at my end.
No, we're good.
I think the battery might be low. I'll continue to talk. We'll see how it goes. Some of the best and most widely circulated evangelical hymn books, these are ones used by independent churches, as you've described it. Celebration Hymn Book, Word, published in 1997. And then the Christian Life Hymnal, published by Hendrickson in 2006. And Hymns for the Family of God, published by Paragon in 1976. All these hymnals have virtually all these hymns that we've been talking about in the mainline churches. So I think there is a strong possibility that we will not lose these hymns. And the question is, how soon do we return to a more hymn orientation and not give up on hymns? I think the experience I describe in my own church is encouraging, when they can use a hymn like Amazing Grace and simply put it in the music category that's more familiar in the modern praise song. So I'm hopeful. I think we will hang in there with the hymns.
Well, that's great to end off here on a very hopeful and optimistic note. I do share your thoughts on that as well. And since we are starting to lose your cell phone with beeps here, this is probably a great place to end. So I've been talking with Robert Coote today. And Robert, Bob, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you very much, Tony. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.